super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake, mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete. Live from the Victory Theater on 42nd Street, happy Halloween from the man who needs no costume, 42nd Street Pete.
Yes, I'm that ugly. Hey, it is Halloween night in New York City. I just watched the parade. I'm heading into the studio now. After we do this little radio show, I'm going to head down to Otto's Shrunken Head and then probably over to the Double Down to finish out the night about 4:30 in the morning and watch the sun come up. But like this time of the year, there's a little bit of devil in all of us, and we're going to raise the devil tonight, and you'll find out why.
It's time to stretch and fetch. See what's cooking at our refreshment counter. You'll find your favorite foods and beverages, plus many new goodies to tempt your appetite and add to your evening's pleasure. Everything's the finest quality. So treat yourself now.
You know, every week it seems I have to do this thing and, you know, it gets depressing. But again, we had lost somebody who was a big influence on my life. And his name was Soupy Sales. He had a kid show in the New York area. He was a nationally known comedian and unfortunately passed away this week at age 83. And Soupy was one of those guys, even though it was a kid show, he did push the envelope. He was kicked off the air a couple times for being, let's say, inappropriate. And as far as I know, he was one of the only people that actually had people protesting out in front of the studio to get him back on the air. And Soupy was in bad health the last few years. He suffered a major stroke and couldn't get around. But unfortunately, probably better for him that he passed away this week. He's out of pain. And Soupy, you were the best. You were a big influence on my life. And you probably warped my little young mind back in the 60s. So rest in peace, bro. You're one of the greats. It's Halloween night, as we said, and you know, at Halloween, we got a little bit of the devil in us, and my guest tonight had a lot of the devil in her. Please welcome to the Grindhouse, Georgina Spelvin.
Yay.
Ooh. No, that's not a devil sound. What's a devil sound?
You would know more than I would, I think. That's a little devilish.
How are you this morning, Pete?
It's Halloween night. It's spooky.
Well,
out there.
Us vampires don't get up until this time, you know, so it's morning as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I know, and hope there's nobody hovering around with a stake trying to drive it through your heart or anything like that.
Oh, no, no. They never aim for my heart.
No?
No. every stake that's come near me, no.
Uh-oh.
Yep.
Whoops!
We can slip up. This is uncensored anyway. It doesn't really matter.
That's what you told awesome. Me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had crazier stuff go on. Trust me.
Probably a lot crazier than it'll ever cross my mind. That's the truth.
Well, actually, it was funny because a couple weeks ago we did a convention up at Ohio, the Cinema Wasteland Convention, and we tried to do a live feed, but all these people were tapping in with their Twitter and stuff like that, and they killed the wireless connection. So we taped it, and it was pretty crazy. We actually had, you would know, Jamie Gillis was with us. He was up there.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, how is that gorgeous thing.
Yeah, he's still in New York. What happened was I was working with an outfit called Wild Eye Releasing, and they were doing retrospects at this theater that's since closed called the Pioneer. You probably don't remember the Pioneer because you were from New York, right?
Yeah, but I don't remember the specific theaters.
Okay, because that was down on the Lower East Side, and basically what they were doing was they were running a grindhouse scenario, and they were bringing it back, and one night they did a complete X-rated night, and they got a hold of Jamie, and we stuck him in the audience, and I was doing a Q&A, and I asked a Jamie question, and nobody could answer it. I go, well, let me bring up Jamie himself, and that's how that started.
Oh, wow.
And we got him to come.
He and his wife have a couple of restaurants there now.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
So we got him out to Cinema Wasteland. He was trepidatious at first because he didn't know what to expect, and the fans just loved him out there. So he did real well.
What's not to love? I'm in touch with Harry, too. We email back and forth, but he's getting arthritic hands, and it's hard for him to type, so we don't exchange a lot. But it's that's one thing about writing the book, boy. I it brought me back into touch with so many of the old guard that I just simply, you know, I just disappeared for 30 years, so I didn't know what happened to anybody.
And that was the book Georgina's talking about is her autobiography or memoir, The Devil Made Me Do It, which...
you remember the name.
Of course. But the amazing thing about this book is usually when I read something about a movie, I'm not tempted to pick it up and rewatch it. But the way this whole thing was written by you, after I got done with that whole chapter or the whole, basically the first part of the book was all about, you know, the shooting, the setup and all that stuff. I actually had to dig it out and rewatch it again and say it again.
Shame
it's a classic.
You.
Well, not shame on me.
Pete, you're full of it. Any excuse you can use to pull out a Georgina Spelvin movie, you're going to use it.
True. You got me there. Some people have this misconception that I wake up and watch porn all day, but they're wrong. I don't do that till 8 between 10, you know, so that happens. But yeah, it really made me watch it. And I, you know, it's definitely worth a second look because it's probably one of the most well-staged, well-written, and well-acted films in the genre. Thanks to you, of course.
Well, thanks to Jerry Damiano. I mean, it was his baby. I just happened to be there to cook meals.
Yeah, I don't think...
That's the truth, people, you know. Nobody ever believes me, and I say, no, I was really the cook on the film.
Yeah, you were hired as the caterer.
Right, and yeah. Supposedly the gal who was set to do the role backed out because she was afraid that it would make her as famous as Linda Lovelace and that she would never be able to pursue her true career as a serious actress. And I just said, oh, now, come on, really? It's a fuck film, for Christ's sake. Nobody's ever going to see it.
That's what you thought, really. Nobody
That's
was ever going to see it.
Yeah, no, I really did. I didn't think anybody would ever know I did it.
And then you told the story about you got a call out of the blue and said, oh, come on up, we're going to premiere your film. And you're like, what film?
Premiere, yes, excuse me. And indeed they did. I mean, that they had an opening in Toronto that was, you know, it was a Hollywood movie scene all the way. It was crazy.
Yeah, that whole thing back in the day. I mean, they paired it with Deep Throat, I think, after its initial run, and it was a must-see.
Well, it's always been paired with the Deep Throat all over the place. Still, anytime there's a festival or something like that, it's always second billing. I mean, that Deep Throat was the first shot.
the gateway film.
It was the first one that broke the barrier into the main theaters, and people suddenly realized that this stuff did exist. It wasn't just a rumor.
No, it's just amazing the longevity of it. And the weird part is, this is a funny story. It actually cost me $50 to see those two films.
You're kidding.
No, this is the story. A bunch of us piled in the car, and we're all smoking and drinking, and we're going to go see this double feature. Well, we got a parking space real close to the theater, but being it we were all hammered, none of us realized there was a fire hydrant we were parked in front of. So we go in and see the movie, you come out, and there's a ticket on my car for $50. And I'm like, gee, thanks, guys. But, you know, in retrospect, it was worth it, you know?
Well, that's very sweet of you to say.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And this book is just amazing because, you know, you just go up over everything scene for scene. You know, you're the first time you met Harry. You had worked with Mark Stevens before this, haven't you? Hadn't you?
Well, that's what got me into the film was because I was just doing production work in films, editing films, just anything I could do to bring in $175 a month to pay the rent on the Pickle Factory, which had originally been a pickle factory, a big old warehouse based down on Little West 12th Street. And this group of crazy filmmakers, of which I was a part, decided we were going to move in there and turn it into an editing facility and a home base for underground movies. We weren't looking to do sex films at that time. I mean, I didn't even know they existed. I'd heard about them, you understand. and I'd seen some footage when I was editing film at August Films. Some blue footage came in every once in a while. Everybody would giggle and carry on. But as far as there being, you know, actually films made of this nature, I didn't know that. I just thought it was handheld cameras in a motel room. So when I got it, I was calling around looking for work and got in touch with this outfit that was doing what they call tits and ass films. They were not hardcore sex films. Oh,
the softcore ones, right.
Yeah, and had bare bosoms. And I had seen an ad in Showbiz paper, one of the trades, saying they were looking, you know, for actresses for this film. And I called. I said, I know I'm not what you're looking for in an actress, but do you need any technical help? And they did. They needed, they were looking for a location, a boat, and I knew somebody who had one, and this, that, and the other. So I put that stuff together for them. And among other things, they said, well, we need an older woman to play sort of a madam. Do you know any older actresses that would be willing to work at a film like this? And I said, well, I'm here already, you know, and, ha, 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 I am an actress. So I did that. And then one of the lighting guys on the film was this Beau Bridges, who came over and handed me a script. He said, I'm going to be shooting this next week. Would you be interested in playing the mother, who's the high priestess of sexual witchcraft? And I read the script, and, you know, it was a script. And indeed, there was one scene in there where this mother, the high priestess of sexual witchcraft, seduces her son. But that's all it said, you know. And so I'm doing this film, and we get to that scene. And the Red Bow says, okay, now you can hop on the bed and this, that, and the other. And I said, wait a minute. He means this, that, and the other, actually. And it was the first clue I had that this was a hardcore film. And I just, you know, I just couldn't bring myself to stomp off the set or something. I didn't know, you know, so it wasn't like it was, I wasn't a virgin or anything, you understand?
Yeah.
So I just went ahead and did the scene. Well, one of the scenes in this film involved the high priestess and her high priest overseeing this great Sabbat orgy and everything. And the high priest was this Mark Stevens. And this was one of the funniest people I had ever met. He just had me cracked up from the first moment. He just, everything he just said it in such a way. He was so droll. If you remember Mark, you know, he just had this rubbery skin and this long, droll face, and he was just very funny. And during the course of this, he asked me if I was interested in more work, and of course, that's exactly what I was interested in those days, as I say, trying to keep this stupid pickle factory afloat. So he sent me over to see Harry. Because Harry was going to be assisting Jerry, assistant director and producer, I don't know, you know, general factotum, about possibly any work that was available on this shoot that Jerry was starting just in a couple of days. So the next day I went over and I talked to Harry, and he sent me over to see Jerry, and they needed a cook, and I said, sure, I'd be glad to do it. I had done such things before. And I lived right in what's now the chicest area of the West Village, but at that time it was literally just meatpacking houses down on Little West 12th Street. That was where.
Oh yeah, remember it well.
Oh yeah, right between Asia Meat and Brookdale Butter and Eggs, across the street from Strache Produce. So I, you know, getting wholesale food was part of my modus operandi. I knew how to put together, you know, food for a shoot for under $500. So I took that job. And while I was there in the office, he says, you know, would you mind reading a scene with this guy that's coming in to audition in a little while? I said, sure, I don't care. And he gave me the script, and I read it through. And so when the guy came in, we read these first scenes from the movie, the Mr. Abaca and Miss Jones interview scenes, And then Jerry asked me if I would do the role. And I knew that this was hardcore, but having just done one, I said, you know, that wasn't really so bad. It wasn't all that difficult. Actually, it was kind of fun.
Yeah.
So I said, well, sure, I could do that. And I did. And that's how that got started.
And the rest is history.
Oh, God.
Then it seems like you were in demand for a lot of stuff. I mean, you had the lead in a lot of the pictures that followed that.
Oh, for the next year. Yeah, after I did that film, I guess the next week, Mark Stevens called me and said, you know, I'm doing this film and they need another girl. You want to work with me on a scene? And I said, well, you know, $100 for the day. I said, sure. And then Harry called me, and he was going to be doing a scene with Sean Costello and Mark and a couple of girls that I didn't know and can't remember their names.
So, Tina Russell, maybe?
Well, not Tina. No, I did work with Tina and Jason several times.
Yeah.
They were very sweet. I really loved that lady. Oh, she was just so nice, you know. It's just a lovely couple.
I know. She was very pretty. I'm surprised she never went any further than she did. And unfortunately, she got sick.
Yeah, well, nobody went any further than that in those days.
Yeah.
If you had made a fuck film, that was it, baby. You were not going to make any other kind of films. And in the last 10 years, that has relaxed. I mean, with what was her name that did the crossover?
Tracy Lords.
Tracy, yeah.
Yeah.
Tracy did very well. Jane Hamilton was in a couple of films.
Yeah. Now Jenna Jameson's doing a crossover now too.
Oh, is she? Oh.
Yeah. Well, she actually. This was pretty funny. She's in a film called Zombie Strippers, and somebody handed me this. I go, you got to be kidding me! And to be honest with you, I sat home and laughed my ass off. It was that funny. It's just that over the top. You got Robert Englund in it too. You know, Freddy Krueger. Hey, I guess it's a natural progression for, you know, how long can you do, you know, fuck films, you know, before, you know, you just burn yourself out and you can't, you know, do it anymore. I guess it's a natural progression to go into B-movies. Because, actually, you did a B-movie, too, for Al Adamson, Girls for Rent, or I think it was I Spit on Your Corpse or something. They had retitled it.
Oh, yeah, I did. No, was that, that wasn't Adamson. That was,
I think he directed it.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing we did out in the desert. Right, that was the Adams one. I also did one for Chuck Vincent, which was, that's because it's so confusing because that was, you know, the working titles are never the titles that they end up being. But the Chuck Vincent film was a horror.
It was an action one, right?
It was a horror movie and,
Bad Blood.
Bad Blood, right.
Okay.
Linda, the Exorcist girl.
Linda Blair, right.
Linda Blair.
Right.
And there was another Hollywood name, Troy Donahue? Troy Donahue.
Yeah, Troy Donahue, right, correct.
Yeah.
I did my homework on this.
Well, I wish I'd have had you as a researcher when I was doing this book, man. I haven't had my morning cough yet. So that was my Halloween horror sound effect for the day.
Okay. That works. We will use that to open it up.
Right. It came from the crypt.
Yes. It came from the throat.
All right, in the crypt or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, you also wound up working with, here's another guy actually did a crossover without even, you know, trying, Sonny Landham, because you worked with him in the Private Afternoons of Pamela Mann.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He wound up doing, he still is, I don't know if he's still working. I know he was supposed to be at a couple of conventions I was at, but I know he's carrying around an oxygen tank and still smoking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was in Predator, 48 Hours, the second Dirty Dozen movie. He's been in a lot of things as a heavy now. Or was it as a heavy?
Well, good for him. That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, of course, I got to do those wonderful two Police Academy.
Oh, yeah, those were great.
Comedies. That was such fun. Wow, yeah. That was...
How'd you get involved in that?
I was working as an editor, and I got a call one day from a casting agent who was looking for me. another editor came by the office and said, "Hey, did you know so-and-so, I keep calling him Baskin Robbins, but it's not, it's something Baskin, are looking for you." And I said, "No shit, for what?" And they said, "Evidently, you know, for some kind of movie." And so I called them, and they sent me over to, I think, Warner Brothers to talk to Alan Ladd Jr., who was at that time was the producer, and then it ended up being Paul Maslansky producing it. But they were looking for a name from hardcore film to do the role of the hooker in the first right. Police Academy. And I said I didn't want to do it, you know, because I said, you know, if I ever make a crossover, I want it to be in a, you know, a real role, not playing myself, as it were, or my persona, Georgina, really. And I said, you know, there's so many girls around that would be, you know, be just delighted at this. And they said, but none of the rest of them are Georgina Stelvin. Well, that got me, you know.
Yeah.
I finished shining their shoes, and then I said, okay, you know, I'll do the role. And it was just great, great fun. And then, of course, they called me to do the third one, not the second one, but the third one, to come to reprise the role. So I got to go to Toronto flying first class, which is the only way I will ever get on an airplane again, may I assure you, if I do that. I'm still stretched out on my back in pain after flying to San Francisco and back last month. Uh-huh. I just cannot stand those little airplanes. The airplane seats are just, you know, if they really wanted to get information out of somebody from Al-Qaeda, yeah, just sit them in an airplane seat for 2 hours. They'll talk.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm 6'2". Todd's 6'4", and he flies a lot, so he could, you know.
How do you guys manage? I mean, I'm a little person, and I'm just literally crippled after an airplane flight.
Todd, you can answer that better than I can, because I don't think they'd let me on a plane.
I'm trying to get you on one. Yeah, it is a pain, and especially like the last time I just got back from Florida, day before yesterday, and I was stuck in a plane that basically was kinder care at the same time. So that really was torture.
I haven't been on a plane that didn't have a screaming infant aboard in the last 20 years.
Yeah,
they come with the territory.
You both know how I look. You know I'm going to be the one pulled out of the line and cavity searched. So, you know, that's why I tend to stay away from planes. I'd rather drive there. Though driving to California might be a little bit much, but...
Driving to California, it's not that bad if you're in a big bus like I was.
Yeah, that was a good story, too, about you. You got an old school bus. You converted it basically into a mobile home, and you drove coast to coast.
Right, the Dora Belladonna. It was
right.
It was quite a trip.
With a stopover for your fugitive warrant trial in Tennessee, I think it was.
Yeah, in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was summoned as a material witness. I wasn't sure. They had a fugitive warrant out for me because I guess they went to my house in Manhattan to serve a warrant and I wasn't home, so they put out a fugitive warrant on me. And even though my answering service, remember the days before answering machines, they had things called answering services,
right,
which were just wonderful, and Seven Arts Answering Service knew where I was. So the FBI shows up at the final dress rehearsal of the musical Anything Goes, you know, In Olden Days, A Glimpse of Knocking, and so forth, at a summer stock place where I was hired for the season to choreograph and direct and also be in a couple of shows. This is a place I had worked off and on for 20 years. And there I am up on the stage at the final dress rehearsal, and these... the director, who's quite a wag and was my sort of almost husband for about 10 years. We lived together. That was before the films and everything, you understand. But here I was back, and he was the director. And he says, okay, I want to go back and stage a little piece of business in the opening. Now, go back to where the cursor crosses to the captain and says, there are a couple of guys, a couple of FBI men wanting to talk to you. So we go back to that place in the script, and as the purser walks over, the captain says, excuse me, captain, but there are a couple of FBI men at the foot of the gangplank waiting to talk to you. And the director, Bishop, hollers back to the back of the theater, okay, this is where you two guys walk up on stage on that ramp over there. And everybody went, huh? And these two guys in suits, and you understand, nobody wears suits in Maine in the summertime.
Right.
Come walking down the aisle, and sure enough, it's two guys there with a warrant for my arrest. And the producer is having, you know, a conniption fit. She says, you cannot arrest her. She's going on in this role tonight. And he said, well, we have an order here, you know, for her. We're to arrest her and take her before the magistrate in Portland, which was the nearest big town, about 40 miles away. And the producer of the theater, who was this incredible woman, Vicki Crandall, and Vicki knew everyone, I mean, including the governor. And Vicki says, look, I will take this actress in to see the magistrate tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. But in the meantime, she is staying here. She is doing this show tonight. You are welcome to attend the opening night. And so forth. Well, they finally, I don't know whether she called anybody or not, but they finally decided that that would be all right, that I could show up at the magistrate's office the next day and do my opening night, which I did. And we went to the magistrate's office, and he was quite bemused that I had been arrested. You know, not often that their summer stock players get arrested. And wanted to know what I'd done, and I told him, you know, that I'd made a dirty movie. And he says, which one? And I said, The Devil and Miss Jones. He says, was that you? That was great. So anyway, he gave me the name of an ACLU lawyer there in town, a wonderful guy. And that guy set me up with another ACLU lawyer in Memphis. So at the end of the season, I bought this bus, drove to Memphis, and showed up for my hearing. I believe this was a hearing before the grand jury. This was not the actual trial. And I went in and before the grand jury, and you probably know this, Pete. I'm sure you've been before one.
Gee, thanks.
But the grand, is that a bad assumption?
No, I only got in trouble twice in my life, once for weed, and you're not going to believe the other thing I actually got arrested for, putting a slug in a parking meter.
Well, that was a stupid thing to do.
No, this is a good story because...
come on, a quarter, a dime.
No, there was a reason I was doing it, but it's beside the point that they cleaned out the whole parking lot just to catch me because I was only doing it once a week. Mm-hmm. And they made like a federal case of this thing. It was on the front page of the local paper, a slug arrest in Denville. And I'm like laughing my ass off because I couldn't believe they went through all this effort. They cleaned out a whole parking lot to catch me. Four squad cars pulled up when I did it. It was amazing.
Well, that's what happens when you get famous, darling.
Yeah. It was funny.
Yeah. Well, of course, a grand jury, you cannot have a lawyer with you. You just go in by yourself. You're totally on your own. And this bank of elderly people, because who else has time to serve on grand juries?
Yeah.
Ask you the questions. And, you know, this particular grand jury was quite befuddled and bemused because I'm sure none of them had ever seen any pornographic material in their life. They must have known what sex was because I'm sure they all had grandchildren. But that was about as close as they'd ever come to anything erotic. And the questions were, you know, pretty politely couched. Let me put it that way.
Hey, all you jive hustlers, you stone foxes, you mean dudes. Watch out, cause Slaughter's back in town. Jim Brown is Slaughter, the baddest cat that ever walked the earth. In Slaughter, he tore up the mob good. Now they want him bad. they're gonna get slaughter or get slaughtered. In Slaughter's Big Ripoff.
Get the hit man, don't get you then slaughter with.
Music composed and performed by James Brown, the godfather of soul.
You better know it.
Slaughter's Big Ripoff. From American International, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent. Slaughter's Big Ripoff. It's hot.
Better know it.
Who's the only one here who knows the illegal ninja moves from the government?
Jackalope 105 FM.
Was that coming from San Francisco and stopped at Elysian Fields for the day for a wonderful day. I asked Ed, you know, I said if there was anything we could do around the place to pay for our admission that day because we had like no money. So he set me to work raking the and cleaning up the horse stable, which was I grew up around horses, so that didn't bother me in the least. And we did that, and then we had a lovely afternoon at the pool and even stayed for dinner and slept that night in our bus. But he said we could not keep the bus there because he would be busted. He was not allowed to have that kind of vehicle on the property. So after that one day and night, we drove on south and finally ended up in San Diego at a wonderful park, nudist park there, which is still there, but it's no longer a nudist park, called the Swallows. Great place. And like that, so that was the trip of the Dora Belladonna across the country.
There was a great little Odyssey story in the book about that.
That was a fun time.
Yeah. You did a film for Carter Stevens called Mount of Venus. I just did audio commentary with Carter for Wicked Schoolgirls, which is coming out. They're putting out two packages of his films.
When you said Carter Stevens, I thought you meant the heavy actor who ended up being sent away for life for shooting his lover and who died in prison. Carter's last name was Courtney. My husband just corrected me.
Okay.
Carter Courtney was the actor who was in the movie. But yeah, Carter Stevens was the director, right?
Yeah. What do you remember about him?
About Carter Stevens or Carter Courtney? Nothing.
Nothing?
I don't, I just remember the day of the shoot, and it was a fun shoot. I remember that.
The funny part is, we're basically from the same town. He graduated high school in the same town that I graduated high school in Jersey.
West Orange? Oh.
Yeah, yeah. He went to, he graduated in, I think, 63. I graduated in 70. So we were thinking they should put up a plaque becoming the town home of two semi-world famous pornographers or something like that. That would be fun. You also did one of the Johnny Wadd detective films, too, The Jade Pussycat.
I don't remember a whole lot about that one either, except that I remember the director, Bob Chin.
Bob Chin, yeah.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful guy. Very patient with me. I was not in good shape. That's the one film I think they call me to do the film. And I had to leave the next day to go to San Francisco for this. And I'd been, on a binge, and I didn't have time to really sober up. And when you're as far into alcoholism as I was at that time, when you stop drinking is when you get really sick.
Yeah.
You can drink until you get really sick, but at this point, if I stopped drinking, I got ill. I mean, ill, like getting the flu. That's the wonderful thing about alcoholism. And I've never done horse or tried to, so I've never had to withdraw from heroin, but I'm sure it's not really all that much worse than withdrawing from alcohol. So I had to keep drinking and try to stay, just sober enough to function, get on the plane and get off the plane and get to the set, and I was a mess. I was an absolute mess. And John was not in much better shape, quite frankly. Equally debilitating. How they ever got a scene out of us, I don't know. And I don't remember very much of it, to tell you the truth. I really don't.
Yeah. Actually, that you did something that I consider pretty courageous is when you addressed the whole alcohol problem in your book. A lot of people wouldn't have done that. They would have glossed it over or tried to candy coat it or something. You just came right out and said, look, this is what happened and this is how I handled it. And you didn't, like I said, candy coat it at all, which I felt was a really courageous move on your part, because a lot of people just blow it off like, oh, I had a problem and that's it. And,
one of the reasons that people don't dwell on it when they're writing their stories, and I didn't realize when I decided to write the book that, of course, everybody had already done this. I was the last one to come along and say, okay, I'll write it all down. But as far as I was concerned, I wasn't being courageous or anything. I was just telling, what happened to me, and a good horror story for Halloween. I'm in Atlantic City to do my last gig as a stripper, because this is what I have been doing to make a living for, the last 6 or 7 months or so. And after having moved out of the pickle factory and moved to San Diego and all the rest of it, and still looking for, some means of making a living, a guy came along and said, well, why don't you, do a strip act? I can book you in all of the theaters that are playing your movie. So that's what I did, and he also suggested that I use a snake in the act because of the popularity of Herman the Snake in the movie. Now, Herman the Snake in the movie, which became almost a symbol of the movie, was a pure accident. Mark Stevens, who's in the movie, brought his snake along with him for the shoot because he didn't want to leave him alone in the apartment over the weekend. Even though they don't need to eat that often, he was afraid it might get cold or something. So anyway, here's Herman the Snake on the movie set, and I'm sitting on the bed playing with the snake, and Jerry walks by and skids to a halt and says, oh, my God, you can handle a snake. You're a snake wrangler. And I said, well, of course I can handle a snake. I grew up in Texas. He said, would you do a scene with it? And I said, what kind of a scene? I don't know. He says, well, I don't either, but if you'll do a scene with it, we'll shoot it. And that's how the scene with the snake got into the film. So anyway, in order to do this big strip act, I rent a snake from Fang and Claw in New York to take out with me on the road. And this one I had picked up just before I left with my mother, thank you very much, because she'd come to New York to help out with an intervention that friends of mine had planned to try and get me to recognize the fact that I was killing myself with alcohol, not to mention tearing their lives up and being a complete nuisance. And so my mother is with me, and we go to Atlantic City, and I do my act the first day, and then the middle of the night, that night, I wake up itching, and my mother looks at the bed, and she says, we got bed bugs in this place. And I said, wait a minute, let me look. And I looked at the snake, and sure enough, the snake had little black things moving all over it, like the black things moving all over me in the bed. And I called the guy at Fang and Claw and told him that, and he says, oh, those are just snake mites. And he said, I'm sorry, I hadn't had a chance to check the snake before you picked him up this morning. He's a new one. And just go to the drugstore and get some bark ointment and put it all over him, and that'll take care of him. And he said, don't worry, they don't bite humans. And I said, the hell they don't.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Mother and I go to the drugstore, and I ask for bark ointment. And the little cute little guy behind the counter says, oh, that's for body lice, isn't it? Which is a nice way of saying crabs.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I think so. So I get the bark. We go back to the hotel room, and here's my mother and I stripped naked in the bathtub holding this snake and slathering this bark ointment all over it. And my mother starts to laugh, and I said, what is so damn funny? And she says, well, here I am, stark naked in a bathtub in Atlantic City, holding on to the tail end of a 6-foot snake, and there ain't a damn soul in the world I can tell about it. That's my mom.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
You did so much work. I'm just looking at this whole, you did so much for Damiano, like For Richer and For Poorer, and then you did like Babylon Pink, and God, the list is just like an endless list of like, most of like the most influential, better shot movies had you in it back, you know, the 70s and 80s.
Ron Sullivan.
Right, right.
Henri Pochard. Yeah, poor Henri. You know, the community of the porn world or whatever, excuse me, out here got together and tried to put together a tape, a DVD to sell to raise money for Ron and for his wife Dolores when he was so ill. And, oh, that was just a nightmare of one disastrous trip after another. You'd have to get a hold of somebody like Penny Antin, who was one of the, she wrote the script for it. But everybody volunteered their services. Ron, Jeremy, and I played the angel, and he played the devil. And it was a very heartening effort. I mean, people volunteered food. They volunteered. Everything was volunteered. Nobody got paid anything, including Vivid. And supposedly all of the proceeds of the sale of the DVD would go to Dolores and Ron. Well, unfortunately, Ron died before it was ever released. But it was heartening to see the way the people in the industry came together for a cause of this nature. You know, ordinarily you can't get two people in this industry to agree on where to have lunch.
Right.
So it was a really heartening experience, it was. And I was asking about Babylon Pink because I thought that had been Ron's film.
Yeah, that was, I think Cecil Howard wrote it or had something to do with it.
Could be. I don't really remember.
Yeah. And then you did Urban Cowgirls with Lee Carroll.
Yeah, that was fun. Jane Hamilton was in that one. And Veronica Hart.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's a real mainstay of the industry and one of the few ladies that I knew and worked with back then who's still active in the business. She's still working.
And she directs. Yeah, she directs
mostly now, yeah.
But didn't she do the Marilyn Chambers comeback one, Still Insatiable, wasn't that her?
Yeah, indeed.
You were the party snob. Before you really hung it up, you did a few mainstream things, too. Like, you got Return to Justice, you were in that with Cameron Mitchell and Joey Travolta. Famous Again, that was you, 98, I think?
Famous Again, yeah, that was a little movie that David Nemod was working on. David Nemod, he wrote and produced Red Ribbons also, yeah, which I did. That was he's an incredible guy. He writes for several magazines now. He's based in San Francisco, and he's my right-hand guy. Whenever I have to go to San Francisco, he's just always right there carrying my books for me, you know.
Yeah.
And he's wonderful. And those films are released through a thing called Water Bearer Films, which is primarily gay material, gay DVDs and stuff.
Okay, Stephen Jeffries was in that, too, and he was in Fright Night, too, the horror flick.
Yeah, well, David's a big horror film avatar. he loves the horror movies, and he goes to all the conventions and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's what me and Todd do. We hit the horror, well, we hit the good ones. There's not so many good ones left anymore, but you know, ones that are really stay true to their roots, like Cinema Wasteland and Rock and Shock and stuff, are pretty good as far as, you know, meeting people and having a good time.
Yeah, I can't deal with those. I know that's where we first met many years ago at one of those conventions. They're just too hard on me. I just can't sit. I don't sit still well anyway. I can't
sit still and
talk to people for 8 straight hours.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I wind up doing it myself. I do panels for Wasteland and stuff like that. If you're ever going to do a show, that's the one to do.
Well, I just went to the Hollywood show a couple of weeks ago here. I was kind of checking it out, thinking that I might actually do a booth next February, but I'm not going to do it. You know, it's depressing.
But you see, the whole thing with Wasteland, it's different because it's more of a celebration of what happened. It's like people are just happy to be there. It's not mercenary. The fans are cool. Everybody gets along. It's just one of those really just cool things.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it depends on what you go in with in your own head. And
yeah.
I'm reluctant. I'm just not comfortable in crowds.
Okay.
Boy, you know, I'm really stumped. At that question. The only thing worse is when they ask me, who was your favorite leading man? The only role, really, that was consistent was the role of Georgina, which I, you know, had to put on whenever I went out in front of people and was supposedly this hot sex star. That in itself is a role, of course, but I've gotten quite comfortable with that one. Of course, I hadn't been on a porn set in 30 years when we did this thing for Ron that I was talking about, the volunteer. We are the X World, I think is what they ended up calling it, the DVD. And I hadn't been on a set in a long time. So I was, you know, older than the average girl when all of this happened. I was 36, and most ladies going into the business were barely 18, if that.
Yeah.
Even though they all had papers proving that they were. I didn't know anything about the business, so I wasn't intimidated.
Right, right.
Well, things sure are different, too. I don't think people realize exactly how the industry was working in the 70s as opposed to now. It was a different world back then.
I would assume so. I don't know very much about how it is now.
It's funny because I went back to this because, like, when you were doing movies, they were actual movies. They had a plot, they had a storyline, they had credible characters.
Scripts.
Yeah, scripts.
Yes.
Now it's gone back to, okay, here's a DVD with five scenes. So it's basically gone back to the loops. That's what it's come down to.
But just like somebody with a camcorder they got at Best Buy. Yeah.
Right. Of course, the early smokers were all at the handheld cameras and in motel rooms or and shown on sheets hung in a garage or the back room of a bar somewhere. And it went from that to the high production stuff. And as you say now, everybody who has a cell phone makes their own.
Yeah. There's no soul to it. I think Vanessa Del Rio said it best when she says it's just not dirty enough anymore. Which
funny.
It isn't. It's just like it's almost like all the women look the same. It's all like the blondes with cookie cutters. You know, they just stamp them all out. And
I don't know
anybody from anybody else because they were all blondes. They were all big chested and all had tattoos.
Right.
Yeah. I'm like one walks up. Hi, I'm Stormy. I go okay. The next one must be Rainy, then Snowy, and it's like oh god. And I'm sitting there going, why the hell did they even put me at this show? I don't have a big enough chest to even warrant being here, you know?
Well, that's the way I always felt. I mean, even back in the old so-called golden days, I'm sure I was the flattest chest in the crowd always. But
yeah, but you know what it was? You were real, and being real, you... In the mind of the viewer were obtainable, where now, you know, nobody could ever, you know, visualize getting to them. Yeah. Where, you know, in the old days where they had real women like you, you could, you know, actually had the faint hope of scoring.
Oh.
Now you don't.
Well, of course, I think most of them today, they all look like the blow-up dolls from the porn shop.
With the Harpo Marx head with the mouth open.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to wrap it up. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Your website? You know, the book is out. The book is called The Devil Made Me Do It. It's
right.
It's www.lulu.com is the publisher.
Just go to my website. Go to Georgina's World. Georgina Spelvin was already taken when I was trying to put up a website. So I ended up with my website being called Georgina's World. But of course, if you Google Georgina Spelvin, you'll get the website. That's one of the first things that comes up, and it's GeorginasWorld.com. And all the information about getting the book is there. The best place to buy the book is Amazon. It's much cheaper. However, I do tell you on the website how to get an autographed copy from me, if that's what you want. And that, unfortunately, I got to charge $40 for because of all of the handling, because of the I have to hire a bookkeeper.
Right.
If I didn't know, had I but known how much trouble self-publication ended up being, I might not have done it, but I did. So there it is. So just Google Georgina Spelvin, and you'll get all the information you want.
It's worth reading. It's well worth the $40. It's worth $100. I've never read a book that made me actually want to go out and watch another movie again, but this was so well written and so well put out that I had to take another look.
Bless your heart, Pete. I just love you.
Same here. You're one of the best, and I'm just thrilled to have you on the show. Sure. Hopefully we can have you on again in the future sometime.
So it's been just a delight, and I hope you have a terrific and fruitful Halloween evening, everybody.
You too. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks to Georgina for being here, and happy Halloween. And for the rest of you guys out there, stay sick. We'll see you next week. This is 42nd Street Pete saying happy fucking Halloween.
Second Street Pete's Grindhouse is a production of Jackalope 105 FM.
Do you feel that? Oh, shit. Oh, why? Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up. Come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Madness is the gift that has been given to me. I can see inside you the sickness is rising. It seems that all that was good has died. Oh no, the world is a scary place. Now that you've woken up the demon in me.
Bobby, will you give it to me?
2, 3, 4.
Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up. Come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Why can't you just fuck up and die? Get down with the sickness. Fuck you, I don't need this shit. I'm down with the sickness. You stupid, sadistic, abusive fucking organ. Down with the sickness. Here it comes. Get ready to die. Get ready to
die.
Come on, here we go again, motherfucker, yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on down and see the idiot right here, too fucked to beg and not afraid to care. What's the matter with calamity anyway? Right, get the fuck out of my face. Understand I can't feel anything. It isn't like I wanna sift through the decay. I feel like a wound, like I got a fucking gun against my head. You live when I'm dead. People equals shit. People equals shit. People equals shit. People equals shit. Come on. Me now, so fuck it. Blood on my face and my hands, I don't know why. I'm not afraid to cry, but that is none of your business. Overdo it, don't tell me you blew it. Stop your bitching and fight your way through it. I'm not like you, I just fuck up. Come on, motherfucker, everybody has to die. People equal shit.